Joe Hollander, chair of the Engineer Charitable Trust, and it's great to see an excellent turnout today. Many of us have been in Singapore at various stages, and when Richard suggested that we should talk about this particular topic, not a lot of people know about what happened leading up to the surrender in 1942. Now, I'm not going to go through a whole lot. I'll let Richard introduce himself, but I think it's probably best to leave it at that and hand over to Richard now, and you can tell us all about yourself and how you became involved. Thanks, Richard. Welcome.
Okay, thank you, Joe. Yes, my name's Richard Jackson. I had 31 years in uniform in the Navy. I subsequently served as the as a civilian as the editor of Navy Today magazine, and then in my final 3 years as editing the Air Force magazine. So I can claim a reasonable sort of joint background. And it was in the course of editing the Navy magazine that I realised that one of the junior officers who had been to Singapore proudly announced that the area that we know as the Stores Basin, and we'll get into this, well, that was the old dry dock that the British built, and he was in fact wrong. And I realised that the story of the Singapore base is something that is sort of lost in either myth and legend. And so my talk today is focused on that backstory. It ends with the dispatch of Prince of Wales and Repulse, and I think you all know how it ends, therefore. But it was in the course of putting this together that I realised that I am not talking about the campaign in Malaya today, but in fact, it is perhaps a story that we might have to get onto the program later on. But today's story is about the Navy, the Royal Navy, and its contingency plan for a possible war against Japan. And as you can see in the title sheet there, that's HMS Hood. And for many years, she was the largest ship, largest warship in the world. Now, if I press that one, does it wake up? Yes. So, taking you back to 1919, obviously the British, Americans, French, Italians had won the war. You could argue that maybe, well, Russia in fact had arguably been defeated by Germany, but it was in the throes of the Civil War. The Ottoman Empire had been broken up. And so the world's navies, major navies, looked like this. The British and its empire had a huge number, 41, 42 ships. The ones in brackets are being built or nearing completion. The United States had a surprisingly large number. Japan was building up its fleet. France, of course, with the war on soil, had in fact built no ships during the war, and therefore they were anxious to modernize their fleet. Italy had its battleships. The Soviet Union, as I say, in the throes of civil war, and so their ships don't really count. Argentina, Chile, and Brazil had had their own battleship race before World War I, so they had ships each. And Turkey, I've noted there out of interest, the survivor, obviously, of the Ottoman Empire. You might recall the story of the German battlecruiser Goeben that was in the Mediterranean in 1914, rushed to the Dardanelles and the cover of what was then neutral Turkey, taken over conveniently with its German crew by the Ottoman government, shelled one of the Russian coastal ports and therefore brought the Ottoman Empire officially into the war. Well, that ship, called the Yavuz, was the flagship of the post-war Turkish Navy and survived, as you see there, operational until 1950. In the 1970s, they offered the ship to the German government as a museum piece, and sadly, they declined. So she was probably one of the longest-lived dreadnoughts of that era. The key point here, of course, is the vast size of the Royal Navy compared with other fleets, and the vast size of the British Empire. And the point I'd like to make here, this map is conveniently located, that if you're sitting in London and you're thinking of what they call the Far East, in fact, the Indian Ocean is the significant strategic point for them. You're familiar with the geography. But I just want to put into the back of your minds that the Indian Ocean, in fact, to the British Empire, is more important than the Pacific. Arguably could stop the lecture at that point. The Great War was, of course, a naval war, and there were naval lessons. The Battle of Jutland was looked at by all the navies of the time, and you may have heard of the American Admiral Mahan, who was a writer and naval theorist before the war, and he was the advocate of the big battle fleet and the decisive battle. And that philosophy, which almost came to fruition in the Battle of Jutland, was obviously still the important philosophy underlying the Japanese and American navies, as well as the Royal Navy. Submarines had made their impact in World War I. The British solution to that was to outlaw them, and in every naval treaty up until the 1930s, their first position paper was, let's outlaw submarines. But the British had also developed ASDIC, the sonar, underwater detection of submarines using active sound waves. I believe it was shared with the Americans. I understand it was highly secret and not shared with the Japanese, notwithstanding they were an ally. And the British tended to assume that ASDIC would solve the problem of submarines. Cruisers were very active, obviously, during World War I. On the high seas, chasing down the various German raiders. And of course, in 1917, 1918, the arrival of aircraft at sea and the arrival of the first flat deck aircraft carrier, these things became important. And in 1918, the Royal Navy was planning an aircraft torpedo attack on the German fleet in its harbour. Quite a bright idea. And the other aspect of World War I is that there were quite a surprising numbers of incidents of ships raiding shore bases or attacking the shore. We're used to these days with images of Normandy and the invasions of World War II and gunfire support of ships against the shore. But in World War I, there were a surprising number of these events. The High Seas Fleet raided the English East Coast. The Dardanelles, of course, in March, when the great British naval attack, the British and French naval attack, failed in the Dardanelles. And the Belgian coast, which was described as the most heavily fortified coast in the war because the Royal Navy was active on that coast, bombarding the shore, and indeed planning an amphibious landing, which probably fortunately never came off. And so the main battle fleet was important, and battleships were the way you counted the strength of navies. This is the then fairly new USS Mississippi, 12 14-inch guns, big impressive ship for its time. So with the end of the war, the Admiralty and the main nations of the Empire were worried about their naval defence. The obvious thing was we were likely to be friends with the United States, but the Japanese, we kind of had to worry about them. Admiral Jellicoe was sent off on a mission around the Empire to report on their naval, their future naval policies. They were coping, obviously, with the sense of independence of the Dominions. And he did quite extensive reporting. Obviously, he too saw Japan as the only likely possible future threat. Nobody saw Japan at that time as being threatening. The politics were all quite benign. Jellicoe suggested an Imperial Pacific Fleet. He was aware that Singapore was the likely to be the best likely base, and he encouraged the Dominions to be part of it. And you can see there with Australia, he recommended they keep HMAS Australia and get themselves another battle cruiser as part of their fleet. And for us, three light cruisers, six submarines, a depot ship, and a small aircraft carrier, HMS Hermes of the time, is probably the model he had in mind. His report was realistic. He factored in the issue of submarines, the issues of the logistic issues and the cost issues. But of course, he was overtaken by the realities that it was peacetime. Economies were changing and, like New Zealand's, were not doing well. So the hard issue of money and Japan was peaceful, and that's all in the future. We won't worry about it now. But Jellicoe, like the Admiralty, saw that Singapore was the best option as a base. There was a debate in London as to whether Hong Kong or Ceylon or Australia should be the appropriate base. But if you're looking at defending your interest in the Indian Ocean as well as the Pacific, Singapore becomes the answer. And so the idea was that it would be a base big enough for a fleet of at least 7 battleships, bearing in mind that Japan had 9 or 10, depending how you counted them. And the decision was made that there would be a base and it would be built at Sembawang on the north end of the island. Now this is an elderly map of Singapore, but if you look at the, I don't have a pointer regretfully, but really at the top apex of the island along Johor Strait is where Sembawang is and where the new naval base would be built. Had an advantage there in that the access to it through Johor Strait through to the eastern side of the island is long and therefore relatively easily defended. Now just jump back to 1916. The United States has not entered the war. The US Navy had its ambitions. Woodrow Wilson, the president, was sympathetic and there was political support for it. So under their 1916 Naval Act, they were going to build a navy second to none. And their obvious comparison, their benchmark, was obviously the Royal Navy. Not through any sense of hostility, but through the sense of, we are a great nation, we will be second to none. You might be familiar with that thinking these days. And so the agreement was reached in the United States that they would build, as you can see there, on top of their existing ships, 4 Colorado-class battleships, 2 larger battleships, and the Lexington-class battlecruisers, of which one is illustrated there. They would be, could have been impressive ships. The Japanese were also keeping an eye on what the Americans were doing. Again, not through any sense of immediate threat, but that's the benchmark that they wanted their Navy to be measured against. So they came up with their 8-8 fleet program. And as you can see, there would be battleships, battle cruisers, 4 and 4, and with their existing 8, that adds up to 9 battleships, they had their program that they proposed. It was lost to a magazine explosion. When you go through the story of the dreadnoughts, it's surprising how frequent magazine explosions were amongst some of those ships, especially in that World War I era. Apparently the problem is that cordite doesn't store all that well, and if you get your magazine temperatures wrong, up it goes, and 100 tons of cordite will soon blow up a battleship. Anyway, the Japanese had this 8-8 fleet program. And as you can see, the ships are getting larger, 42,000 tons, 48,000 tons for the Lexington class. And the Royal Navy, which had just won the war, had a whole slew of battleships, 25 functional of battleships, without counting the battlecruisers. The Royal Navy was recovering from a war and did not want to get involved in a naval arms race, but they had to do something. So you can see there what a big fleet it was relative to the others. But the difficulty of it is that almost all the ships were pre-1916, whereas obviously the new build Japanese and American programs would have the latest, including the Lessons of Jutland, built into them. I make a note of the 3 large light cruisers that you may have heard of. They all would have become aircraft carriers, as we'll see in a moment. So in summary, the 1919-1920, these ships were committed to by the governments of these countries. So the United States Navy, the Imperial Japanese Navy, and the Royal Navy all had immense and expensive programs to build ships. I'm told I have read that the The Japanese Navy's budget represented roughly 30% of the entire national budget. So it wasn't something that, you know, that we were really on the edge of affordability for all three of these nations. And just to illustrate, the British battle cruisers, which were ordered before the Washington Treaty, would have looked like this. 9 16-inch guns, all mounted forward, the engines all aft, and this was one of the Brit designers' conclusions from the Battle of Jutland. So, big ship, 48,000 tonnes, 850 feet long, 30 knots, would have been impressive. But the Americans realised there was an opportunity here to save the government's money and to take the tension out of this arms race that had kicked off, and called for a treaty to limit naval arms. So this became one of the first and most successful arms control agreements. There's a lot of complexity to it. It's possible to write an entire book on the Washington Treaty. But the essential point is that the US Navy and the Royal Navy were in parity for battleships. Certain limits were placed on this new technology of aircraft carriers, and cruisers, destroyers, submarines all had various constraints on either the size of the ship affecting the quality of the ship or on the total numbers. And the bottom line is that the British could build two 16-inch gun battleships to equate to the American Colorado class or the two newest Japanese battleships. No ship could be larger than 35,000 tonnes, therefore HMS Hood, which had only just completed at 42,000 tonnes, was the largest warship in the world. The Americans were obligated to scrap one of their Colorado class that was incomplete. They promptly took her out to sea and tested their armaments on her, so they actually got up-to-date information on how to build a strong battleship against modern guns and torpedoes. And they could convert two of the battlecruiser hulls into aircraft carriers, and similarly for Japan. Now, one of the other results of the treaty, because the Brits were interested in Singapore as a base, the line of longitude, 110 degrees, which runs from the western end, left-hand end of Java, touches on Borneo and then skims Vietnam and goes through Hainan Island in China, so right down the essentially the centre of that map. Nobody could fortify bases east of that line. So the Brits couldn't fortify Hong Kong, the Americans couldn't fortify the Philippines, and the Japanese couldn't fortify their mandated islands of the Marshalls and Caroline Islands. And the intent, obviously, was to make the Western Pacific a peaceful zone. The non-fortification clause did not extend as far as Hawaii, which obviously was important to the Americans. Now, one of the other results is the Brits were allowed to build two ships, Nelson and Rodney. This is Rodney at one of the 1930s fleet reviews. And as you can see, the British kept to this concept of all guns forward and engines aft. And the Americans completed their two battle cruisers as aircraft carriers, became the Lexington and Saratoga at the top of the picture. Saratoga has the black vertical line down the funnel to distinguish it from Lexington. Those of you who recall the Falklands War might recall that the Argentines and the British each had Type 42 destroyers. The British painted theirs with a big black vertical line down the funnel and down the hull, so that casual aircraft pilots could tell them apart. So Saratoga and Lexington, which proved to be very successful carrier conversions. And the Japanese similarly built two or converted two carriers, and you can see there the flight deck of Akagi as she was originally converted, and next to her is the 16-inch gun battleship Nagato. Japanese battleship names were named for provinces of Japan. Oops, sorry, we've gone too far. You had a very brief glimpse of, oh, there it is, we can get
back somewhere to previous. Lost my cursor.
Okay, so this is Glorious and Courageous with the two British light battle cruisers, and they were basically useless in their build role, so they were happy to convert them into aircraft carriers. And you can see, in essence, they've taken the long, slim hull, put a big box on top for the hangars, and a flight deck on top of that. And by this time, they were all well settled in the idea of the aircraft carrier should have an island for the bridge structure on the starboard side. You might have noted the aircraft numbers. The British carriers had quite small numbers of aircraft relative to the Americans and the Japanese. And the other point I'd like to make about the aftermath of the Washington Treaty is that the British started investing in a series of submarines designed for Pacific operations. The basic concept was you could base a submarine at Hong Kong, sail it up to Japan, conduct a two-week war patrol and sail back to Hong Kong. That was the essential specification for three classes of about 19 submarines that operated, once they were built, operated from Singapore up until June 1940. The British submarine commander, Alastair Mars, who wrote a number of books after the war and had served in the 4th Flotilla, was convinced that had there been a full flotilla of submarines at Singapore in December 1941, they would have played havoc with the Japanese invasion forces. Sadly, they weren't. They'd been deployed to the Mediterranean. Now, again, in the aftermath of the treaty, the Brits needed to reassure the Empire that the Royal Navy knew what it was about. So a special service squadron was formed of Hood and Repulse and a bunch of cruisers, and they sailed around the Empire, South Africa, India, Malaya, Australia, New Zealand, then up to Canada, called in obviously at the United States, and through the Panama Canal and back to the UK. A major event, and in the mysteries of Facebook, this photo turned up remarkably on time for me, taken off Napier, showing the Napier Harbour Board launch taking dignitaries out to the Hood, anchored off Napier. Apparently the mayor of Gisborne created a fuss that Gisborne was not to be visited, so he got in touch with MPs and whoever he could find, and I still don't know whether Repulse was visiting Gisborne at the time or whether they sailed past, but I do know that the mayor of Gisborne was very upset that they weren't on the schedule. And one of the ships in the Special Service Squadron made it as far as New Zealand and then stayed with us, and that was HMS Dunedin. So she arrived in 1924, and as the squadron departed, she stayed at Devonport, hoisting the New Zealand flag as its jack, and replacing the Chatham, the first cruiser of our division. Now, when you've decided to build something like a big base in a far distant place like Singapore, inevitably politics intrude. We heard of Transmission Gully, for example. So politics intruded, and having decided they would build a base, they felt that maybe it was too big, and then the Labour government was elected, so they cancelled the whole damn thing. Within a few months, the Conservative government was back, and they got it going again. New Zealand was put under pressure, and they realised it made sense. If you think of the realities of the New Zealand Defence Forces at the time, the best thing to do was contribute money to the new base. Australia did not contribute to the new base, but they had committed to building two of the new county-class treaty-defined cruisers for their navy. By 1929, the Labour government was in power again in the UK. By that time, the floating dock, which was a part of the original plan, had been built and delivered with a capacity of 50,000 tonnes. It was one of the biggest floating docks in the world. And then, of course, comes the Wall Street crash and the Depression. And so the by this time it's 8 years on from the Washington Treaty, and the naval powers had agreed in the Washington Treaty that they would convene a follow-up conference. But as part of the preparation for the London Naval Conference and to show Britain's good intent, work on firstly the defences and then the base itself was cancelled in 1930. But just to look at some of the defences, there was of course an argument between the brand new RAF, who said we can defend the base with torpedo bombers, and the conventional thinking of the Navy and the Army saying you need gun coastal defences. And the argument about that in favour of guns was it would take too long to design and build the aircraft, and the concern is would they be there at the time, and the argument with the RAF was, well, you don't actually get around to installing the guns. Now this was the 1925 torpedo bomber, a Hawker Horsley, and two squadrons were in Singapore from about 1928. This is the dry dock that had arrived in 1929. And so in 1930, the naval powers convened for another treaty discussion to follow on from the Washington Treaty. It's the Depression, so nobody wants to build battleships. They all agreed pretty quickly they would extend the ban on building battleships for another 5 years. So till the end of 1936. There was a lot of fine-tuning around the details of who had what ships, and the upshot is that the numbers of ships in commission in the navies was kept to the same ratio, 15 American, 15 British, and the Japanese dropped from 10 to 9. And in addition to the operational battleships, certain ships were retained as training ships. In the case of the Brits, Iron Duke, one of the World War I battleships. Similarly, USS Wyoming. The Japanese took one of their Congo-class battleships and said it would become our gunnery training ship. I hadn't actually mentioned the Congo-class were designed and the first one was built in the UK. And in 1914, the Congo-class were considered as the world's best battle cruisers. And the other ship of note, USS Utah, an old battleship, was converted as a target ship. And you might recall from, as you're aware of Pearl Harbor, that she in fact became torpedoed and sank at Pearl Harbor. The London Navy Treaty led to the new category of cruisers. There'd been a lot of expense paid for the building of the 8-inch gun, 10,000-ton cruisers. The Brits couldn't afford it, but they needed lots of cruisers for the size of the empire. And so the category of light cruisers was created. HMS Leander was the very first of the ships built by the Brits to be the exemplar for their idea of a light cruiser. The Japanese and the Americans promptly took the 10,000 tons and the claws and built 10,000 ton light cruisers. The case of the Americans, the Brooklyn class. In the case of the Japanese, they designed their turrets so they could be plucked out and replaced with 8-inch guns later. And the main advocate for submarines was in fact France. France somewhat resented being, they were on the hind tit, as it were, in terms of battleship numbers. And so they were the main proponent of submarines in 1930. Now over the next decade, the world starts to change. And so obviously Japan, its government became more militarized or influenced by the military. And indeed it was the army largely behind the Manchuria incident, which had them take over the Manchuria province of China for their own resources, iron ore and coal. And another incident at Shanghai. And the League of Nations, which had been operating quite effectively, obviously the Americans were not part of the League of Nations, but the League of Nations were critical of Japan, so they got in a huff and walked out. And a year later they gave notice that under the Washington and London naval treaties, they would not take part in any new treaties. They did not renege instantaneously. They were signed up to the London Naval Treaty, so they were signed up to the end of 1936 for the battleship holiday. 1937, obviously, the main China-Japanese war begins. And just to get ahead shortly, the Sino-Japanese War includes the Japanese moving south steadily around Hong Kong and taking Hainan Island. And then, obviously, once the war breaks out, they move into French Indochina. So this map shows Japan's expansion. It doesn't show the Japanese and French Indochina at that point. But the key thing is they're coming closer to Malaya and Singapore every step of the way. There is a small error in this map in that where it shows Guam, Saipan as being US, it was only Guam which was a US territory at that stage. And obviously it was unfortified. Now just a quick look at completing the base. After the flurries of 1931 to 1933, in 1934 the British said, let's go ahead and complete the base. The dry dock was built and finished, and it was, when opened, was the largest in the world. The dry dock is up to the right, up here. And this is the stores basin. And it was declared operational. I believe the north wall, this photo is looking south, so the north wall is here. The north wall was not yet finished at that point, but there was still ample room to berth ships. And instead of the original £15 million that had been budgeted back in 1923, they'd spent about £60 million. And this map actually locates the naval base, again, as I say, at the very apex. And compared with the first map you saw, the causeway was completed. I believe it was completed in the early 1900s. So the naval base is open to attack only from the eastern end. And we're going to talk about 15-inch guns. And so a battery of three was built at Changi. And a battery of two, which could cover some of the west as well, was established roughly about here. So the 15-inch guns obviously were somewhat inland because you don't want commandos raiding them and putting them out of action. And with a 39,000-yard, it's kind of a 19-mile range. Singapore itself is roughly about 20 miles across. So gives you a flavour for how far out into the strait they could cover. There's the dry dock being built. Now the island's defences were another saga, even as the base was being built. Now these are the island's defences against seaborne attack. And there were obviously politics involved. The Admiralty wanted guns, the Air Ministry wanted torpedo bombers. Finally guns were approved. Trials were undertaken about long-range gunfire to protect against ships. And the conclusion of trials at Malta and in the UK was you had to have air spotting, because of course there was no radar in those days, that was essential. And in 1932 they finally got the mountings for one of the guns completed, and as a temporary measure the Monitor, which was a short shallow draft ship with two 15-inch guns, was moored in the in that eastern channel as protection for the naval base. Now this is what a 9.2-inch coast defence gun looks like. Across the British Empire there were over 200 of these installed, including Wright's Hill at Wellington. Apparently quite an effective and impressive weapon. Now in 1935 the world starts to accelerate and things are becoming quite dramatic. Hitler was in power. That year he renounced the Treaty of Versailles. That's a problem. The Brits and the Germans reached a naval agreement allowing the German Navy to be 35% of the strength of the Royal Navy. Now the immediate implication of that is instead of the Royal Navy facing Japan and no other opponents, the Royal Navy was going to have at least one third of its fleet committed to facing off Germany. At the same time, Italy invades Abyssinia. And so we have to take into account the Italian fleet. But of course, the French will look after the Mediterranean. And meanwhile, the Sultan of Johor is one of the coronation anniversary presents, gives £50,000 to the British Treasury, who allocate it to Singapore's defences. And an army general by the name of Dobby is the fortress commander, and he is the first one to say, hey, look, Singapore's vulnerable from the north, because all the defences that we've been talking about are coastal defences pointing south. And in 1935, too, the Japanese fly the first prototype of their NEL, shore-based naval torpedo bomber. And when you compare it with the Hawker Horsley, which I've shown you, or the Vickers Wildebeest, the NEL was a high-performance aircraft, not a carrier-based aircraft, but nonetheless a high-performance aircraft. The British land-based torpedo bomber was the Vickers Wildebeest, and those wildebeests began replacing the Hawker Horsleys during 1935-1936 at Singapore. You may be familiar that wildebeests ended service with the RNZAF as well. One brief point here that was new to me is the intention, of course, was to replace the wildebeest with the British Bristol Beaufort torpedo bomber, which, a bit like the NEL, was a two-engine shore-based aircraft. British industry was trying to expand, so the arrangement was Australian-built Beauforts would come to Singapore. The Australian-built ones were to have American engines, but what was the American aircraft industry doing in the late 30s, early 40s? It was expanding. Engines were in short supply, so by the end of 1941, only seven Australian-built Beauforts had been built, completed, and so none came to Singapore. The Wildebeest was our frontline torpedo bomber in 1941. Now, before the war actually starts, the Brits put a lot of thought into how to deploy the fleet. Obviously, they expected to deploy from the Mediterranean, and they would have to use some fueling bases on the way that had to be secure. And so their proposal was, Aden was well established as a coaling port, but they were to establish a fleet anchorage at a bay, this is in Yemen, north of Aden. Atoll in the Maldive Islands, great tourist resort these days, has a big atoll and suitable anchorage, and that would be developed. And indeed, during the war, this was developed as a secret base. Trincomalee is the big natural harbour in Ceylon, Sri Lanka, and it was the other obvious base. And during the war again, it was not built with lots of shore facilities, but with store ships and the like there. And they proposed a little base in the Nicobar Islands, but the Japanese took over the Nicobar Islands, so that never stayed academic. The point is, they thought about the logistics of moving their fleet. And this is what Royal Navy afloat support looked like. Unlike the Americans, who focused on underway replenishment at sea, the British looked for secure anchorages, and this is Malta, but the point here is there is a depot ship, a maintenance ship available. This is the battleship Warspite, this is a county class cruiser, and there's a big floating dock. So the British concept was that you had territories and identified bays and harbours where you could move your store ships, anchor them, and your fleet could go and replenish from there. Very different from the American approach, which was you've got your oil tankers underway and refueled underway at sea. So here's the fleet underway, or there you've got a flashing glimpse of it. The other thing I need to mention is the Far East Combined Bureau. This was the British intelligence organisation. It was tri-service. It was very good. By 1940-41, they had a good handle on Japanese activity and on Japanese order of battle, and even on Japanese aircraft like the Zero. The difficulty that you have to understand is none of this is slow moving. In 1940-41, things in Japan happened very rapidly, In 1940, it's probable that the Japanese government did not know it was going to go to war in December 1941. Things moved fast, and not all intelligence could keep up with the events. But the Far East Combined Bureau was very good, and in fact played a part in the initial breaking of the Japanese naval code that the Americans are so proud of. Now, a quick look at Singapore's coastal defences. This was as planned and as finalised. So, in total, five 15-inch guns, six of the 9.2-inch guns, and 18 6-inch guns to fend off ships from attacking the island. Searchlights, fighting lights, which are searchlights, as you can imagine, and there are also fixed searchlights which serve to illuminate areas. They took a focus on anti-motor torpedo boat defence, in other words, small craft raiding the harbour. And at the same time, the Admiralty is admitting it's going to take longer and longer for the relieving fleet to reach Singapore. And that should have been the big alarm bell. This is one of the Singapore 15-inch guns. Here's the dry dock being opened with due ceremony. That's the governor's yacht. And the dry dock was used. There's Queen Mary in 1940. The other ship you may know, Dominion Monarch, a passenger liner that came to New Zealand. She hastily got out of the dry dock before the Japanese. Now, this is the naval base. It's a 1966 photo, but the essentials as they were in 1941. And so you can see it's a big industrial complex. The dry dock, as I say, the wharves along the western northern edge, and the stores basin, which is on the left side of the picture. If you can make it out, the first aircraft carrier is Melbourne, and the second aircraft carrier is Victorious. And this is Triumph, which by that stage was a repair ship, an ex-aircraft carrier. So the fleet, the base, was capable of handling big ships. And this is a 1953 view, and there's the 50,000-ton dry dock, obviously sunk during the war. I presume it was salvaged and broken up. I don't know whether it was put back into action. So a quick reminder of 1942, the anti-MTB defences were quite extensive, but the anti-aircraft defences, they had been given due priority and they were reasonable for the time. And I've got this out of sequence, but 1937, the point I want to make about 1937 is on the 1st of January 1937, because remember the naval treaty had ended on the 31st of December, on the 1st of January the British laid down the hulls for two of their class of five battleships. And so in 7 months they laid down five battleships and four armoured aircraft carriers. More than the Japanese, more than the Americans. They put in a huge effort from 1937 onwards. These are really just to show that under the treaties, the Brits, Americans and the Japanese had been building aircraft carriers. And so the war breaks out, and as you know, Germany invaded Poland, Italy joined in, Germany invades the Soviet Union, which gave the Royal Navy a commitment to convoys to Russia. They also started focusing on the Persian Gulf route, which was another major source of supply to Russia. And then in November 1941, the Japanese make their decisions to go to war. So before we get to the war, obviously there was a lot of worry from Prime Minister Churchill and others and Australia and New Zealand about what's going to happen to Singapore. And in 1940, the Admiralty was committed that they would send HMS Hood, two more battleships, this is an R-class battleship, heavy cruisers and 12 destroyers. So they've already given up the idea of a fleet that can match the Japanese. What they're trying to put out there is a strong enough fleet to cover the Indian Ocean convoys. They're not going to take the war up into the Japanese waters and meet the Japanese fleet head on. And in August 1941, by then, of course, the Hood has been sunk. They start to rework their plan, and this is what they tell Churchill in that month, that they would have battleships and carriers based on Trincomalee in Ceylon, The old R-class battleships would cover troop convoys. The battlecruiser Repulse was already committed to a convoy escort duty that would take her to Ceylon. And in the Eastern Mediterranean, they had battleships, carriers, and in the Atlantic, the home fleet, and Force H on Gibraltar, more battleships and carriers. Now, this is the August plan. But in November, it all starts to go wrong. Before the Japanese have entered the war, between U-boats and Italian frogmen and minefields, they start to lose ships. So you can see I've asterisked various ships in that time that were sunk or damaged and taken out of the equation. So the point remains that to reinforce Singapore, the pool of ships available gets very, very small very, very quickly. Now, Repulse, as I say, is heading on a convoy. This photo is taken with the convoy down to the South Atlantic. Most of the convoy is headed for Egypt, and Repulse goes on to Ceylon. The Japanese, of course, are preparing for war, and they've committed in their plans that they will have a major air group of shore-based torpedo bombers, including the NELs that I described, based at Saigon. And in the South China Sea, they would cover the Malayan and the Philippine landings with two battleships, heavy cruisers, light cruisers, and the destroyers. Now, this force of battleships and heavy cruisers on the 10th of December was concentrated in the South China Sea, south of Vietnam. The British, of course, Churchill is very espoused with the deterrent theory that if he can put a modern battleship in Singapore, that will deter the Japanese. What we know now, of course, totally unrealistic an unfortunate decision. The Admiralty obviously wanted it to be in the North Atlantic, but Prince of Wales is sent out in a hurry. And so on the 8th of December, Singapore is attacked just after midnight on the 8th of December, Singapore time, which is about 6 hours ahead of Pearl Harbor time. And so Repulse here and Prince of Wales sortie to meet the Japanese invasion. Even if they hadn't been sunk by air attack, my thesis is that the two Japanese battleships and the eight heavy cruisers would have finished them off anyway. It would have been a bloody battle, but the Japanese had sufficient naval superiority in the South China Sea that Prince of Wales and Repulse would not have survived. As you know, they were finished off by air attack, and then that leads to the Malayan campaign and the subsequent British surrender. Not a proud moment, and there is Japan having conquered most of the Western Pacific. Now, I might have gone on a bit long. Thank you for your patience, but that's my presentation. My key point is that the Royal Navy was focused on Singapore. They did put an effort into the defences, and they did put an effort into their planning to respond to Japan, but essentially, from the late 1930s and with the rise of Hitler, all their planning was overtaken by events. And they had to change very, very radically, and their interest shifted from Singapore to covering the Indian Ocean. Thank you.
Thank you, Richard. Fascinating story. We do have time for any questions or comments, so please. Oh, Dennis.
Was the level of disappointment by New Zealand and Australia as to the slowness of building up Singapore, wasn't there?
I'm not sure if there was during the 30s, but there's certainly, in looking at Churchill's volumes of the Second World War, he's at least honest enough to devote an entire chapter to what he calls Australasian anxieties, as he gets more and more worried cables from Wellington or Canberra, Wellington or Melbourne, saying, what the hell's going on? And while Australia did not contribute to the base, it contributed a lot in terms of the reinforcement of Malaya in the 1940-1941 period. So yes, both Australia and New Zealand looked at not the base per se, but the fleet that would come to the base as their prime line of defence. And it was clearly not going to materialise. And I suspect London was never fully honest that there's the Admiralty saying, look, we can send out three battleships and three heavy cruisers in 1940. And if Wellington or Melbourne understood that, they would have been most upset. So yes, I think you're right, a lot of disappointment from our end of the world.
What was the extent of Japan's aspiration? Did it include Australia and New Zealand? Was it a global aspiration or was it more regional?
Well, as I understand it, if you follow the Navy leadership or the Army leadership in Japan, you get two different answers. The Army wanted to conquer China. They were prepared to take on Russia. I mean, as you might know, in 1939, the Japanese Army got a bloody nose from the Russians, and that sobered them up quite a lot, but they still were convinced they could conquer China. They wanted Burma because that was the West's link to support the Chinese nationalists. So I'm not sure that they ever seriously looked at taking Australia. They certainly wanted to cut Australia off by having the Solomon Islands and probably New Caledonia, Fiji and all that. They wanted to cut Australia and New Zealand off, but I don't think they seriously looked at the prospects of a genuine invasion.
We had nothing to offer.
Well, do you think the Brits really underestimated the Japanese from about 1939 or 37 onwards?
Yes. I think that's my Bible here is a fairly recent book called The Royal Navy in Eastern Waters. And it's this author who sings the praises of the Far East Combined Bureau, the intelligence organisation. But whether that sunk in London is not at all clear. There was probably an underestimation. The Royal Navy itself said, oh, the Japanese, they're probably only 80% as good as us. And that's why I think they were reasonably relaxed about battleship numbers, that they tended to have an inherent sense of superiority over the Japanese. I mean, bearing in mind that the Royal Navy had quite a lot to do with the Japanese in World War I and in those early 1920s. And then I think the other point, I probably didn't make it properly, that from 1935, technologically, the world accelerated. Up until 1935, the world flew biplanes with 500 horsepower engines. After 1935, everybody was building 1,000 horsepower engines, and they were building Spitfires and 109s and Zeros and whatnot. The acceleration in the aviation world was quite immense, and it would have been hard for a policymaker to keep up with it when you look at the sort of pace of development. But the other point is how relatively slow the United States and Japan itself were in that post-1937 period to build up their fleets and their relative forces. So I think, yes, the Brits underestimated the Japanese quite badly.
Time for one more. Was Trincomalee attacked?
Yes, in April 1942, the Japanese put in two forces into the Indian Ocean, one of which had five of the Pearl Harbor aircraft carriers, and they attacked both Colombo and Trincomalee. At the same time, they put a light carrier and the cruiser force to raid merchant shipping in the Bay of Bengal. Very successful, very productive raid. The upshot was the Admiralty gave approval for the British Eastern Fleet to retreat to East Africa.
Hugh.
Well, I want to know a simple question. What's the difference between a battleship and a battle cruiser?
Back in 1912-ish or so, battleships tended to be built for a 21-knot speed. Battle cruisers were to replace what were then the old armoured cruisers, and the idea was that they would hunt down cruisers and raiders at sea. They would not stand in the line of battle. And so they would have bigger, more powerful engines for high speed and possibly a slightly less armament. And when you're doing all these equations of designing a ship, they probably had thinner armour as well. So that's the essential part of it. It was a different role initially. Yeah.
Well, look, please join me in thanking Richard again. That's quite a fascinating